Okay, folks, let's take seats and get going, if that's okay. Well, thanks. My name is Ed Lazowska, and this is the session that's called a Roundtable on Investment Models for Synthetic Biology. I'm a computer scientist, which sort of leaves me odd person out at this meeting. My principal connection to synthetic biology is I was chair of the DARPA Information Science and Technology Advisory Committee in 2003 when Drew Endy and a set of others led the first major sort of synthesis study of synthetic biology, which in many ways I think launched the parts-based community. And from a computer science point of view, there are a lot of analogies to synthetic biology. During this session, we'll continue the discussion of open source versus open innovation, for example, which has a lot to do with investment models and investment incentives. But really, from my field's point of view, we're in the business of complexity management. And complexity management is the reason that today you can design integrated circuits with billions of transistors. And 25 years ago, we could design integrated circuits with tens of thousands of transistors. So it's not just that they're smaller and you can fit more of them on the same die. That's, of course, the case. But the real issue is, what are the design tools and what are the composable units and how do you make them larger and larger over time and still preserve that composability that allow teams of reasonable size numbers of people in reasonable amounts of time for reasonable amounts of money to design things that are orders and orders and orders of magnitude more powerful and more capable than they were just a few years ago. And that's the path that synthetic biology is traversing now. And that's the leverage of this parts-based composable approach. We're going to divert a bit from the pattern so far. The plan for this session is that each of the panelists is going to give you about a 5-minute introduction, just telling you where they come from, and then we'll have a discussion with you. So we really want your active participation in this, both as people asking questions and as people answering questions. So we'll say a little more about this, but there's plenty of expertise on the panel, but there's plenty of expertise in the room, and we want to have everyone participate in this next session. So let me tell you who we've got here, and then I'll invite them up one at a time to just give you a bit of background. Mark Waxman, on my immediate left, is the chair of the healthcare industry team at Foley & Company. Greg Kisor is vice president for investor relations at Intellectual Ventures, an organization in Seattle and the world these days. Paula Olszewski is program director at the Sloan Foundation. And Yanis Economidis is the principal scientific officer of the European Commission. So we've got a lawyer, an investor, a foundation person, and a European. That, I think, covers the bases. We've checked all the boxes, and we're ready to go. So with that, let me invite Mark to hop up here and give you a bit of introduction.
Thank you very much. Having virtually two lawyers in a row, you have my sympathies. We feel like kind of a, after hearing that last discussion, Richards, I feel like kind of a skunk at the part at the picnic. You know, we come in with a different bent in terms of what some of the issues are. I come to the investment side. I guess we first got involved looking at the investment side of this in the representation of Phoebit in connection with the investment of InQtel into Phoebit, which was one of the investment that Cord was talking about yesterday, a particular kind of investment model that we'll may have an opportunity to talk about. What I want to do briefly is to chat a little bit about sort of a view of the investment environment taking off of the last discussion that we had. And looking at this, some of this is perceptual, but you could see this is kind of a little bit of what the public may be starting to think about synthetic biology and where we may be in a couple of years. And while this is cartoonish, of course, you can see as you look at what the headlines are that are actually behind this type of cartoon, it's a little different. And this is just some of the recent thing, because I think this helps inform the environment. We go from the first one that sounds good about bugs eating waste and excreting petrol, that sounds really great, to big questions about technology, to the Army slows bio research at the Maryland Laboratory. Those of you that read the newspaper articles about Fort Detrick and the various things that were going on there, you kind of asked the question, you know, are we one vial away from disaster here? If something happens, are we all of a sudden going to see a different type of environment? George Church's, you know, are we creating life from scratch? To something, you know, world-changing, we're now interplanetary, to, you know, synthesized ethics, bringing in an entirely different element, and then to the ultimate pragmatism, you know, gene therapy gets under the skin, going under nails and under the skin to help cure people. So the reason I point this out is say, look, this is, as you invest into this, both from the public and governmental perceptions, this is what it is that people are thinking about. The Woodrow Wilson folks, who I know are here, you know, they've done a nice summary showing the news coverage going like this over the past couple of years, talking about, you know, sort of the themes that people are thinking about. And I think we have to be a little bit careful as we keep talking about designer organisms, playing God, and Frankenstein-like pictures coming out of this that create problems, coupled with this whole notion of, you know, biosecurity. Is this really a threat that people are concerned about? Yes, but is it something that has to dominate our discussions, or do we need to, again, temper the vocabulary that's there? We just heard, I think, what I would call a fairly distressing and depressing discussion about the patent thicket. The question is, you know, is this enough to kind of kill the whole thing and we should all go home and maybe, as was suggested, await the litigation? I think a positive view of that would be no. I think the answer to the question, you know, should we get into it now? I think the answer is yes. We ought to get into it now. We ought to look at what some of the patents are, and we ought to have a better understanding of where the blocks are and where they aren't. Is it a good idea to await the litigation? You know, those of you that kind of follow the patent world, I mean, the Qualcomm litigation with broadband and Texas Instruments and Nokia has been going for years. It didn't stop innovation. It was good for our profession, but didn't stop innovation necessarily. The litigation that's gone on in the genetically engineered crop field also been good for our profession. Didn't stop innovation, but could there be a better way? The answer to that, I think, has to be an obvious yes. There could be a better way, a much better way, and I think it requires some sort of affirmative look at how this might work. And the question is, who's going to lead that affirmative look on some sort of collective, collaborative basis? I think it probably has to be something in the order of a trade association who says we're going to take a hard look at this, or a collaborative probably on the not-for-profit side who says we're going to take a hard look at this, potentially supported by industry as well. So the answer is real joint effort viable? I think my answer to that is yes. I don't think we ought to all just await, you know, the continuing expense involved in sending my kids to college. Next piece, we touched on a little bit, you know, the lack of regulation. Yesterday, there's a lot of regulation out there for people who, you know, you run a lab, you have to open a lab, you have to get a license. You want to run certain kinds of facilities, you have to get licensed. You want to get patented. You want to get something through the FDA. But there isn't any real specific regulation that is focused on synthetic biology per se as a regulatory matter. So the question is that a good thing, or is that an inviting target? I think it depends whether how you see the public perception. Sometimes when there's regulation, the public feels more protected, that somebody's looking at this, they've seen what's important, they've seen what isn't, and some sort of regulatory environment may be helpful from that perspective. Sometimes you have regulation as something else. And as I say right now, SynBio may be regulated because it may be a pollutant, it may be a pesticide, it may be a contaminant, it may turn out people think it's nanotechnology. Those of you from Berkeley know, you know, the city of Berkeley wants to do something with nanotechnology, and then you end up in a regulatory problem that you have lots of different people maybe trying to regulate the same thing, and you end up something like stem cells. Stem cells, you could, in California, you could have the gouvernator give you a lot of money to go do embryonic stem cell research. If you're up in the Dakotas doing the same research, you go to jail. Right? That wasn't a very good regulatory regime. So somewhere we need to step in and avoid what I call the crazy quilt of regulation that I think we've seen with stem cells. One of the things I think is worth a good look is, you know, why not use the proposed amended NIH guidelines that came out for recombinant DNA research that have now added on synthetic biology, and maybe we could use those as a baseline to expand the regulatory environment and adopt it on a little broader scale. These were published in March. The comments are in. They start talking about a taxonomy of risk as we look at, you know, synthetic biology. In that case, based on, you know, certain strains and whether it's a two-thirds of an existing viral genome or a half or something. But it was a start. I think it was a way to look at how we're going to address the research phase, how we're going to prioritize risk and relate the risk to how we're going to do the research. I think that might be a good start. It doesn't get you to the next phase, which I mentioned in my question yesterday. You know, what about scale-up, distribution, and sale? You know, how do we go about thinking about regulation there? Again, this is something that, you know, we don't want to patchwork. We don't want to, anytime you have SynBio rolling through the streets of Berkeley, you have to go register it as a model, which obviously would pick up everything from perfumes to tennis rackets. I'm not sure what the goal there was. And we clearly need to address the need for international harmonization. I mean, this stuff gets mailed through the mail all over the world. To have one set of regulatory environment here and another one there, again, isn't going to be very helpful. Insurance, you know, this is a question I've written about. You know, is there going to be some sort of SynBio exclusion in certain kinds of insurance policies that if you're working in insurance, you know, if you need insurance to commercialize, right, you need to protect your workers with workers' comp insurance. You need, if you're going to make products, you got to have products liability insurance. You know, how are you going to go about handling that? The insurance industry, Swiss Re in particular, is looking at this. I think an intergovernmental insurance exchange, as has been suggested, is probably unnecessary, but it's something that sort of we need to think about. End of the day, you know, kind of where do you end up? Is there a possibility of a public-private partnership? There's a lot of talk about this. There's a lot of talk about, you know, can you put together these screening watch list hotlines and clearinghouse all together as an industry and say we're going to have a nonprofit center to this? I think the answer to that is yes. I think it's a good idea. I think government ought to fund it. I think industry ought to get behind it. You've got IASB in Europe already coming together with a code of conduct project with some technical solutions that they would like to put in place. If we could do that and adopt that internationally, again, I think another positive step. Here in the U.S., we formed the Synthetic Biology Industry Association in order to start thinking about this collectively as a trade association from industry. One of the great things about this room is you have an awful lot of people from the academic side, from government, from NGOs, from the charitable side. I think we need an organized industry presence because, as you heard with respect to the patent world, industry sees these things a little different. Industry sees this, can we create a market? Can we do return on investment? Can we get these things out? Consistent with the Bayh-Dole Act, of course, but on the other hand, that ROI. So there's an industry voice, Phoebit, GeneArt, Sutro Biopharma, IQT, InQtel, Blue Heron, BioSearch Technologies, and Integrated DNA Technologies have already joined this association. Be happy to talk to you about it if you want to do it. And the question here at the end of the day is, I mean, who's going to convene the solution? We have a lot of conferences that sort of bring people together. The next step is we need to have one where people sit around the table and say, okay, if we're going to regulate, what's it going to be, who's going to do it, and how are we going to move that process through without killing it? Because it's an industry that everyone says has purpose and value, and let's not get caught up in the thickets. Thanks.
Sorry to disappoint everyone, but I didn't prepare slides. So an interesting point in my life came on Wednesday. On Wednesday, I woke up to the news that the Pope had declared patents evil, and the Swedish Pirate Party had declared Elvis evil. Now, I mean, I know it seems kind of strange, but in both cases, it's because they were protected by intellectual property. Elvis is protected by copyright. In fact, his current estate makes more money per year now than the collective years he was alive. It's pretty phenomenal. The Pope made no comment about Elvis, but he did make a comment about patents, and in particular, those in the area of healthcare and the fact that there's just been a systemic failure, to solve the developmental problems surrounding the zealousness to enforce intellectual property and keep things away from those that have real need. So I have to tell you, I was spending the day on Wednesday. I knew I was coming to do this, and I'm just wondering, you know, which side of the fence should I be on, and what should I do? Because, you know, what? By the way, I'm an Elvis fan. It's my chosen song choices when I go do karaoke. So I was really questioning myself, because even my fallback career after patents was at risk. So, but nevertheless, it's true. There are definitely real issues around the use of intellectual property. In my company, if those of you that don't know of us, everybody wonders whether we're evil or not, because we are effectively a company that does a venture investment model in intellectual property. We do spinoffs and things like that, so there possibly will be products along those lines, but we really are focused on intellectual property. SynBio is a small part of an investment in two of our funds, but really, one of the things that I see is that the raging debate here, we have 95% of the debate taking place in something that's actually a much, you know, single digit percent of the developmenting world. But it's interesting to see this debate, because we really live in an exciting time. SynBio offers promises of all kinds of things. I teasingly tell my children that I'm going to live to be 150, so they need to learn how to put up with me. And I actually think there's a promise that that might be possible, although some people say I'm crazy for wanting that. But this is an exciting time, and we need to figure out how to encourage innovation. And this goes not just for SynBio, but in general. Advances in technologies and so on are just going at a rapid pace, and innovation seems to be stunted in some cases by somebody's desire to make a dollar. And I would say, I actually think that those dollars are actually what's causing the desire to innovate. So before you brand me an evil, raging capitalist or whatever, I'll just capitulate to it. The debate about IPR is something that is not new at all. The earliest case of it in the United States that I could find was a debate in the 1820s over patents around heaters going into homes. They had developed a new radiating kind of heater, and it was being protected, and only one producer in Pennsylvania was producing it. And there was a debate that it would allow the poor to have proper heat with less, you know, material going into the heater, therefore it should be declared open for the public good. And it was rather interesting to see that that's a similar debate. You go with the Wright brothers and their aircraft. They actually, for World War I, the Secretary of Navy had to basically force them to open their patents up so aircraft could be built. Fast forward, software, originally software, even the ability to copyright software was challenged. People said it should be free with the hardware. And now we're, of course, debating patents on software, and when are they valid and when are they not, and so on. And I think that that's very similar to a debate that you'd have about SynBio. You know, when should the patents be allowed and when should they not? And, you know, what's the scope and what should be allowed to be protected? What should be open for research and so on? One of the things that I know because I live in this world is that regardless of how you want to do it, property rights drive the ability to have wealth creation. And without wealth creation, you don't have investment in innovation. The public good alone would put us to the point where we're solely relying on philanthropy and the government, basically the governments, to fund innovation. And that even will dry up if there's no wealth creation. So property rights sort of drive the need for wealth creation. So in this, we need to preserve some way that wealth creation is still possible while allowing for innovations and innovations to be built on top of innovations. It's kind of ironic that the very property right that most people think is a barrier to access is probably the only vehicle people have to ensure access, to ensure proper usage of the technologies. Because without intellectual property, you have no way to make sure somebody's, you know, you have no way of saying they must open it up, or they must produce for third world countries, or they must allow researchers to have access to their innovations and so on. So I welcome the questions, I welcome the debate, but I'm sort of falling on that side of the issue, and I'm here to advocate that we need to find a space for IPR in this. We need to find a space where research can occur, and it's done such that all research is possible. It's done such that the public good is served, but it's also done that we have a growing, healthy industry. Thanks.
Good morning. First of all, as a sponsor of the meeting, I want to thank you all for coming and sitting in the audience and listening to the wonderful talks and so on. And I've found this meeting to be incredibly exciting. Now, I didn't have an Erector set when I grew up, and my parents didn't go to college, but I had a microscope and I had a Gilbert chemistry set. So maybe that's how I ended up getting a PhD in biochemistry at MIT. I don't know, but those early experiences make a difference. So why do I care about synthetic biology? Well, when I took my job at the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, I was hired to develop a new scientific program area in biotechnology, whatever that meant. I also was asked to work on our bioterrorism program, and this is pre-9/11, and was interested, the foundation was interested particularly in issues of potentially dangerous research in the life sciences. All right, so suddenly I'm working at the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, being paid to study, work with really smart scientists, engineers, people, ethicists, lawyers, and again, both looking for important projects in basic research to fund, as well as in looking at potentially dangerous research in the life sciences. So that sets the stage. Okay, may I have the next slide, Stephen? I want to then mention two early important grants. We do our work by studying problems, identifying smart people to work on them, coaxing them to write a proposal, and then funding them. We give grants. It's a very exciting and rewarding professional opportunity. I have two grants listed here. One is a 2001 grant to the National Academies, and Joe Husbands is here somewhere, the PI on that grant, and that ended up becoming the Fink Committee report, which actually is called Biotechnology Research in an Age of Terrorism. And that was really a landmark report because it said there are some experiments in the life sciences where you really should think about it, and then listed a series of recommendations, which I'm not going to talk about. But it was a very important thing because should there be regulation in science? Well, there already was some. Was the RAC, were those, I don't want to call them, whatever the RAC, whatever legal term is, you know, is that enough oversight and so on? All right, so working away on that, but remember, I had the microscope, I had the chemistry set, I read science, I read chemical and engineering news, and there I see in chemical engineering news a picture of Drew Endy and some students holding up flashing bacteria. And I said, this looks good. Okay, but remember, it's sometime during the time we had the anthrax attacks and so on, so the bioterrorism program got a little more exciting because people were very interested in it. But anyway, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about synthetic biology. So I started following synthetic biology, and I thought it was really exciting. I went to Synthetic Biology 1.0, met a number of the people who are in this room. We invited Drew to give a talk, the Sloan Foundation. The science and engineering blew us away. I said, okay, Drew, what do you think? That's how we work. Get a great person in the room. And Drew said to me, I think you should work on the societal issues. Takes up so much of my time, we need to some good answers. So I took the good advice, and that led to a 2005 grant, which is a joint venture, the Venture Institute. They're definitely doing the science. CSIS definitely understands the security implications, and MIT, Drew's group definitely understands the engineering, and they put together a consortium of scientists, various leaders from ethics, whatever other, from soup to nuts, and came up with a report called Synthetic Genomics Options for Governance. And this was our first big splash in the synthetic biology arena. And I think that's been a very important report. I think three out of the four people are in the room today, Jerry Epstein, Michelle Garfinkel, and Drew Endy, who are authors on that. And again, I think what's really important about that report is that it gives options. You can leaves it to others to determine what the risks are, because depending upon what you think the risks are, that will help you select your options. So we also, during that time, we underwrote the societal issues sessions at Synthetic Biology 2.0 in Berkeley, 3.0 in Zurich, 4.0 in Hong Kong. One of the things that's been really wonderful with this is I've traveled all over the world, and again, hearing really interesting, state-of-the-art science and engineering talks in this fabulous field, as well as engaging people on the various issues. So in 2008, we decided to take another look at what we were doing in synthetic biology, and we wanted to go beyond synthetic genomics and some of the biosecurity issues to look at some of the other issues. We see a lot of promise in this field. We hope that there will be wonderful products that will help with our environment, with our health, and any other application that may come along. And so I'm going to step back so that I don't get these in the wrong order. But we had several goals. We wanted to improve understanding of ethical, social, and policy issues by the scientists and engineers. We wanted to improve understanding of the science and engineering by the policymakers, journalists, and the public. We're committed to improving biosecurity and biosafety, but we also wanted to create a cadre of young scholars working on the societal issues, and I don't know if Paul's still here, but I'm still using that term. All right, so may I have the next slide, Stephen? And so we have three projects. The current project is the one that's incubating or happening right now. Anne Marie Mazza is the PI on that. This is this meeting. We had a planning meeting, very exciting for the Sloan Foundation to be able to participate in the brainstorming and, again, meeting all these international collaborators. I'm going to mention three projects. The Hastings Center, the people from that project are here. That project is led by Tom Murray and Greg Kebnick. They're here. I'm not going to give a lot of detail on the projects because you can meet the people. We have a project with the J. Craig Venture Institute. Michelle Garfinkel is here. Lori Knowles. Paul Thompson of Michigan State is also part of that project. And then we have the project that was alluded to in the first speaker at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Dave Rajeski at the back is the PI on that. Andrew Maynard is in here. And since Dave's actually giving a talk tomorrow, I'm going to say the least about that. Stephen, may I have the next slide? All right, so the Hastings Center, again, why are we working with the Hastings Center? They're a high-quality ethics center. So we're interested in, one of the reasons we funded them is to do serious scholarly research on the ethical issues in synthetic biology that will help inform policy discussions. Roger Brent graciously agreed to be their scientific advisor. With all of our projects in the societal issues in synthetic biology, it is key to have top synthetic biologists involved in the discussions. Engineers, biologists, practitioners of synthetic biology working directly with the social scientists, philosophers, and ethicists. And then I list the three topics that they're going to review as part of their study. And I may have the next slide, Stephen. All right, then I'm going to mention the Venture Institute's project, okay, and it's called Synthetic Genomics, Scientists' Understanding of Society's Concerns, Society's Understanding of the Science and the Scientists. Two sides. We expect that this project will help the scientists and engineers better understand how society views their work. We also want to educate journalists so that they can better inform the public about synthetic biology. We also want to inform policymakers to help them structure better policy. There is a, we also, actually, I won't say any more on that, I think. And Stephen, I'm not going to go through the methodology because it'll take some more. And then one slide on the Wilson Center. Many of you may have already been to some of their events. Their goal is to identify and start to address the risks in synthetic biology. They've had some fabulous events. Mike Rodemeyer gave a talk. The people from the Hastings Center presented some of their work. They've had several things. If you haven't been to their website, I urge you to go there. So anyway, the Sloan Foundation has probably spent at least $2 million investing in addressing the societal issues in synthetic biology. We think it's very important. We have not, we encourage others to invest in this part because I think it's a very important area, and I'll answer questions later. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm the European, as everybody heard. What I would like to tell you is how a European institution like the European Commission is investing in this particular part of science. And of course, you can imagine that is part of a whole structure of investment. Now, talking about synthetic biology, I hope. Okay. We started with a given definition back in 2003. It was a high-level invitation of scholars where they came and they gave a definition of the field. You may agree or disagree with the definition. However, it was a working document in order to start thinking how we can proceed in this field. And the elements, of course, were to address biological systems, as many times we have discussed in this meeting, with the tools and the language of engineering. That was the main principle. Now, coming from this document, there were two calls for proposals, and they came out, and yesterday there were discussions on that. Two sets of projects, they came out with 18 different projects. Some of them, do I do it wrong or whatever? Yes. Some of them, they survived through the publications and the peer reviews and anyway, the public relations that they make. Some of them probably they went out to their final report, but some of them probably you know the acronyms like the Emergence or the Probactis. You have heard about it on SymBiocom, SymBiology, SymBioSafe, and TESI, where we have a representative here, and some other projects in which we don't have really the details to go on it. So the major elements of that were to come with some topics dealing not only with basic science, but biomedicine, new generation of pharmaceuticals, new chemical compounds, to approach the issues of environment and energy, and production of smart materials, and some issues, as we just heard the last speaker, of issues of security and safety. This is history. Then we came at the era of the seventh framework program. For the non-Europeans, a little bit of background. This is the major funding system of the European system. And it has several elements I'd like to show to you. It's a program that has a funding for 7 years of the level of 53 billion euros, and it's breaking in different dimensions. The two elements that we have to take into account is the one on the top, which is called ideas, and this has the basic elements of research. You have heard apparently from the so-called European Research Council, and this any open-ended type of research, blue sky type of research, and of course it has some projects of synthetic biology. And the other ones which we care about is people, because that involves fellowships, young people. We've heard before lectures on the importance of the young people, so it's for young scholars to exchange their experiences. And the major funding comes from the program called Cooperation, which involves different other small programs, more thematic programs. Now, you could have imagined that synthetic biology can fall between different disciplines. The one can be health, the obvious one. The other is the food and environment. The other one can be nanomaterials or new materials. However, it was a matter of choice. Some of these programs did not really respond to this kind of provocation of the new times, but some others they did. I'm lucky enough to belong to a program called the Knowledge-Based Bioeconomy, and I'm going to tell you a few things about that, in which we responded to the issues of synthetic biology. So the knowledge-based bioeconomy, it's very sketchy. It deals with three elements. One are the biological resources, and one, of course, the biological resources can be the agriculture per se. The second one is the processing. So when you have biological resources, you go to two directions. One direction is for food, and the other is for non-food. I belong to the part which is non-food and has the most advanced biotechnological techniques. And I don't know if it's right or wrong, may come from the discussion. Synthetic biology, we used it as one more advanced tools, one more part of the emerging technologies of biotechnology in order to promote bioeconomy. Because biotechnology is not science per se, but it's a technology, so it has to give services and economy to the society. So we have a modest call for proposal at the beginning, and we came out with one project. Victor De Lorenzo yesterday alluded around this kind of ideas, is how to use synthetic biology for approaching, tackling environmental issues, aspects of bioremediation. And there was a modest investment of 1 million euros and to accumulate scholars to come around and create the critical mass around this particular issue, using synthetic biology for environmental issues. Getting more courage from this project, this project has several working elements. And the one is the conceptual frame, since this is a new discipline, the genetic tools, the design and modeling tools, the biodegradation approach, going specifically on the issue, and as colleagues said, social, economic, and environmental assessment, safety, biosafety issues, and the aspect of training and dissemination, because at least with the public perception, we have strong issue in Europe. And of course, training is a sine qua non issue of any field of science. Now, in the following, yes, in the following call of proposals, we went to better investment, around 3 million euros, and we said, instead of approaching the issue of environment, let's ask what synthetic biology can do in general for biotechnology, and in this case, we defined even what we want to do from the elements of synthetic biology, because synthetic biology covers several issues. And this is what you see in the blue, and the most important thing to have to create maybe the chassis or to create the tool for going through different applications of synthetic of biotechnology. So it came out with this is hasn't started yet. It's under discussion. The finalization is a project which has eight labs. Is to modify the chromosome of the Bacillus subtilis, and to create the tool for having new and more focused biotechnological applications. Now, very quickly to another programs that there are these people that are working on socioeconomic research. They have two projects, one called SynEthics and one called SIBHEL, in the, where they are dealing and analyzing the LC issues, which can be focused new or not new, because it's a matter of debate, on the of synthetic biology. Now, the type of investment that we do, we try to have the so-called stakeholders, I mean, from the different affiliations and disciplines that you can see on the slide, which have, of course, we need the industrialists as well, small, medium enterprises or bigger industries. Now, I'm finishing by saying that besides giving money and following the projects, we try to have networking. So we have three types of networking. One is the European networking per se of the thematic work, and one is the collaboration just mentioned, the basic research of the ERC and the people, the fellowships. The second one is that we have asked every country that sits as an advisory countries, and we have 30 countries around the table, to have a network, so the KBBE, the Knowledge Based by Economy Network, and to have designated specialists from their field and to come and give us more or less advice and tell us what they are doing in the member states. And they have a working group in the initiative of Germany, a working group on synthetic biology. And that works very well. Of course, because it's a governmental, it has an irony. One of the member states has that major activity in synthetic biology is not represented there because they're bureaucrats or they're administrators. They haven't thought carefully about this field. And then yesterday we were discussed about the European Group of Ethics, where they give advice to the president of the commission, and they come with they will come with a report now in September that will be public in the net, how the European Commission and the Union are thinking about the ethical issues of that. Okay, and the second type of networks is what we have in Europe. So we have the FP7, we have the ESF, the European Science Foundation, we have the EMBO, that they have activities, the Royal Society, that of course is organizer of this meeting, and the Royal Academy of Engineering. And the third one, and I'm finishing, is that the international network that we try to participate is the international conferences that we just heard, the OECD Working Party on Biotechnology, which we try to complement our work with their work, and the finally, last but not least, and there are several members here, the EC-US Task Force on Biotechnology Research, where funding agencies from this country, from the United States, and European Commission tried to discuss about the cutting-edge research and see how we can bring the two communities from both sides of the Atlantic together. Thank you.
Okay, so this panel is about investment models, and of course there are lots of possible investors. There are government funding agencies, there are foundations, there are corporations, there are private investors. And I'd like to begin by discussing this landscape a little bit, and let me start maybe with a couple of analogies to software, which I know a lot better than biology. One thing I'm interested in is understanding the balance of investment between tools and applications, right? And my sense is that there is a large amount of funding for applications, but not a lot of funding for the tools that will allow one to build the next generation of applications. This is, well, you know, I'm sorry, I was too busy solving the problem to build tools. And if I think back to the integrated circuit revolution in the late 1970s and early 1980s, DARPA made very, very substantial investments in tools, tools that made it possible for people who understood the architecture of systems to build integrated circuits. And that's really what created the revolution. It was the construction of those tools and the dissemination of those tools and putting those tools in the hands of people who understood system architecture rather than taping up integrated circuit masks. My feeling is that one of the many things DARPA whiffed on in the past 8 years was synthetic biology. We put a huge amount of effort into our ISAT study in 2003, and a lot came out of it, but it wasn't through a sort of DARPA decision to invest. It was through a set of people realizing that there was enormous promise and they had to move this ball forward on their own. So that's sort of the first question, which is what is the tools versus application investment balance, and is it appropriate, and if not, how does one change it? Any of you folks have any opinions? And again, we're happy to hear from you as well. Mark, do you think about this at all or not?
Well, I think I disagree with you.
Great.
I think there's a fairly healthy, at least at the thought side, perhaps the dollar side less clear, as between tools and applications. I mean, I see the gene synthesizers, I think those working on different types of gates. I think the people involved in sort of the BioBrick effort, you know, all of those in my mind are the tools that are later on going to become the applications. You read a lot about the applications as you look into sort of energy and things like that, but I mean, I personally think it's balanced. The other question that you inferentially asked, and I'll just answer it, had to do with, you know, how are you going to invest? You know, who's going to do it and how? You know, and in my mind, there's really four models that are out there that people do invest with. I mean, one is, you know, the standard VC model. And so you ask the question, where are they investing? I think they're, given the current investment cycle, and others may answer this better, you know, they're looking a little shorter term than they were in the past. And so I think that tends to focus more on tools maybe than applications. There's the tech transfer model, which was mentioned in the prior discussion. The tech transfer model looks at, you know, a little bit of each and has its own model, and people can go online at Harvard or MIT and see what the tech transfer model looks like. You know, the third is the application model. I mentioned, you know, the InQtel investment in Phibit, which actually was an investment that didn't take the form of a normal stock purchase. It took the form of a work order that would be exchanged for warrants going into the future as a model. And the last, I think, is kind of the Gates model, or the Chavi model, the Chavi being the Center for HIV, AIDS, Vaccine, Immunology, which is sort of long-term problem-solving that also involved tools by a government funder with infrastructure, collaboration, and a centralized database. So I guess I see it as maybe a little more robust on both sides than you might.
So tools versus applications. I think that tools, funding for tools, does help jumpstart an industry in the semiconductor integrated circuit example is a great one. But as far as the venture community, yes, they're very focused more on return and more near-term return to try to bring solvency back to a lot of their current investments. But I think in that regard, they're actually more focused on applications than tools. They actually want something that that's going to go to market, that's going to create a return. And tools are useful only if it helps you bring applications to realization quicker. For example, you know, in the SynBio area, there's some people working on some what you'd call synthetic yeast to make, you know, beer and wine better, okay, and make it more consistent, make it create a more consistent product, regardless of what went into it, the materials that went into it initially. And that's definitely an application. It's definitely something that people are going to invest money in because there's a huge industry and so on. But the building blocks there likely have a lot of reuse for other areas because it involves a transformation of a chemical transformation. And so in that respect, they look at that as sort of a tool, as a basis for what other applications can be spawned on top of it. But I think generally the focus is more, maybe that's short-sighted, but I think at least the industry and venture community is actually saying, you know, how can I make money on this? And I'll throw money into it because I want wealth creation. I want a sustainable industry. And I think that most of the investment in the building blocks, the tools, and so on is coming more from either philanthropy and government or people doing core research.
So let's talk about build. Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, I'd like to make a comment on this. First of all, I think there has to be data, at least in terms of what the U.S., the NSF, has funded in synthetic biology. I don't know what the data is. I know I saw Zoe over there. But I think that in the U.S., there should be data. Maybe it's not all collected. But it would be interesting to see specifically where the money went, okay, in terms of and how much there really is. I also know that various companies do those reports on the venture firms. So I think that you know, it's great to sort of talk about this, that, and the other thing in terms of the different opportunities. I really hope if someone has a report on the data, I would like to see that. When the Sloan Foundation was doing the assessment of what to do in the societal issues, we saw very little investment in the U.S. In the societal issues. And again, we only have a relatively small amount of money compared to the big funder in the U.S., and that is the government. So we were very careful before we entered into this area. But if somebody has those data, I'd love to see them.
So let me ask about reuse of components and sort of another software analogy, which is the sort of open versus closed business. And we talked about this by email before the panel a bit. Rick did a great job in his presentation in the last session talking about open science, open source, open standards, and open innovation. And they are different, and it's easy to confuse them. But one thing I'm interested in is whether there are adequate incentives for investment, for private investment or corporate investment in an open world in synthetic biology. Right. That is, it's possible to sort of overdraw analogies, naive analogies between software and biology. So can you imagine investment incentives in an open world? Another question is whether we've got a situation where the government and foundations are allowing people to corner future markets with public or foundation money. So, you know, to state this in the extreme, and again, this is referring to our email conversation, should the Department of Energy have said to Jay Kiesling a few years ago, look, you know, here's your $100 million, but you have to make these parts you develop open and publish everything you learn through the course of this project, right? So I think this whole open versus closed issue is a really important one.
You know, it raises, in my mind, the question of the debate about whether the Bayh-Dole Act has been a success or not over the long haul, because it raises the same issue. Fortunately, I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that, and this is why I mentioned it, you know, there are models out there which the government has looked at in other sectors which require you, as a condition of getting the dollars, you're required to contribute the technology back into the pool in order to make it available for others. There's also the model of the stem cell patents that WRF has, where they have agreed, in essence, to license that to research uses, and they'll come back and talk to you later if you start making money, but at least they want to get the technology out
and principally licensed out to other nonprofit entities. I think the government, to answer your question, ought to look very hard at grants going off into the future and requiring, if there's the IP coming out of those grants, consideration of bringing them back in and making them more generally available to help, A, fund the pool and fund the next generation of research. The theory behind that has to be that this type of research is actually going to open up an industry as opposed to close it down. You have to believe, and we've seen this in software, that by creating platform-type technologies, you're going to end up with more industry and investment in the end than you have now. And there's a trade-off that's very difficult to make at the beginning. But once it's gone, I mean, one can compare what's gone on in, as I said, you know, between Qualcomm, Nokia, and the rest, and say, look at that situation, as opposed to more other environments, and say, do we progress?
Let's take some questions from the audience. We've got a line at the microphone back here.
I guess I want to have some questions about how to best structure investments in tools. I would respectfully disagree that there's a significant investment in tools and very little public representation in the tool bases that are being built out. For example, construction of genetic material has largely been driven by private investments. The last public investment I'm aware of came out of the Advanced Technology Office at DARPA in 2003. With the sequencing projects, we saw significant public investments and thus representation in the development of tools for reading out DNA. What role should public investment have in sustained improvements to getting better at building genetic material? Second, along the same lines, but as a specific example, if you look at the geometric growth of the BioBrick parts collection, this is driven by a bottom-up set of students all over the world. It's a very controversial project because many people think biology is too complicated to standardize and share in this way. Should we expect this project to succeed by itself, or do we need to see professionally staffed production facilities akin to a genome center come into existence to make higher quality parts and address some of the concerns that come from our betters and more senior folks in, say, the national academies? As a third example of public investment, to be very specific, last year 1,500 new parts showed up. If we are to assign very strong property rights to them so that we can give them away, patents would cost us about $30 to $40 million last year. That would be 10 times the budget, if you will, of the actual event which produced all those parts. We're not going to pay the lawyers that much money. If we had it, we'd probably make more parts. How do we invest in a legal framework that actually comes to life, not at some imagined point in the future, but how about in the next 12 months, that will solve this problem for us? A final example, how do we make investments in community? Again, using BioBricks, when that collection got started, every new genetic component had a signature built into the DNA. This supports naive colony PCR characterization, presence-absence tests in the environment to figure out whether or not there's BioBrick parts around. If you're interested in establishing a standard of practice as an engineer, that an engineer will sign their work. If you're interested in making the future problems around biosurveillance easier, how could we pay for this? Practically, we couldn't do it with the lack of investment because the community grew geometrically and our funding sources from any source did not scale. So as four specific examples, construction of genetic material, professionalization of parts collections, a legal framework that actually works now, and establishing a community, what would be the ideal balance of private, public, foundational investments in getting this to happen? Thank you.
Well, great questions, Drew.
Okay. So taking them a little bit, I agree that there's very little public investment, and the private investment, most of us aren't going to talk about what we're investing in. So, and in that respect, even if we're investing in tools, it's not necessarily going to be tools that are open-based. So I tend to agree. Part of the second question, I think, was about a student-based development effort. Will it succeed? Does it have a chance? And so on. And I say it has. I would say that yes, it has a chance to succeed in spawning people's interest and encouraging industry to take notice. There's several examples of early stages that happened. The first real sort of open source effort that I was aware of that did that was something called the Independent JPEG Group. I'm aware of it because I was working in image compression at the time. But I was trying to run a business that was about doing development on image compression, and here a bunch of college students got together and gave the code away for free. and threatened my business model, and I eventually capitulated and went to work for IBM. But but it succeeded, though, I think, in allowing people to have a fundamental building block, a tool where they could actually try out concepts in building new products, and it was quite successful, as anybody who's watching television or whatever nowadays understands, that digital imagery was quite successful. So I think that it's an effort that should be encouraged and has a possibility of doing a lot of great good. A legal model that works. I think the gist of the question from Drew was about, you know, who in the heck's going to pay for the patent filings, that it's an order of magnitude, right, of the
No, sorry. The question was, is there a legal framework that preserves the accessibility of those parts while making it unnecessary to spend $30 million on patents?
Right, but there is a legal framework that can do it, but one of the first issues is you don't even need a legal framework if nobody can afford to file the patents, right? So
some corporation could presumably make some of that
inaccessible. But I think the two are inevitably tied together. There's a legal framework and a commercial framework that actually accomplishes both. And it's something that could be done now, and it's one where you have an independent sort of a patent pool sort of situation. We've seen those work successfully, where the patent pool in and of itself becomes sort of an independent arbiter of what should be in, what is relevant, what's valid, what's enforceable, and so on. Independent JPEG group is one example of that. I keep going to imaging because that's part of the world I live in. But they actually also set a basis for what's reasonable royalty for commercial applications built on top of the intellectual property. The whole Qualcomm situation that's being referenced a couple times, one of the issues is Qualcomm requires quite a high percentage of your handset, basically for the radio component, essential coverage on the radio component, which nowadays is a very small part of the actual intelligent handset. And an interesting aspect would be if somebody could acquire more essential patents than Qualcomm owned in a pool and charge a much lower basis rate, that would put at risk Qualcomm's ability to say that what they were charging was fair and reasonable. So in an enforcement situation. So I think there is a legal framework that allows a sort of the intellectual property come into a holding environment where one of the terms is that innovation on, it's open for innovation. In other words, access for further research, access for doing early stage product development and so on is allowed for all the intellectual property within that. And I think that or for basically public good works, supplying things to third world countries or using it for philanthropic sort of funded efforts. But for commercial efforts, it would still preserve the rights for people to build products and for wealth creation to occur in that area. And it would be done in a way that makes sure that the innovators get that money flows into the system instead of buying new beach homes for attorneys, which is basically what happens whenever litigation is the result. And not that I have anything against a beach home for an attorney. I just think that we need to establish a system where it's not by default half the money is going out of the system, but it's staying within the system and the wealth creation is allowed to spawn better and better innovation on top of it. Thanks.
I want to make a comment about the investment in the science and engineering, Drew's point about the tools. Anybody in here who applies for grants knows it's going to go through peer review. If it's not hypothesis-driven research, it's not going to get funded. I think that the Sloan Foundation made a decision up front to tackle the societal issues because we felt that that was an unmet need. But we do, in other areas, fund basic research. And we always look ahead to say, what is the exit strategy? And the exit strategy generally is that you make a compelling case so that somewhere in the U.S. government, there's funding for this. So I think that, I know the community has been working hard at this, but basically, there has to, maybe that's an outcome of some meeting, that, you know, that there would be some analysis to make the case that in order for the synthetic biology to succeed, we need the tools, we need the exploratory research, and that has to be funded. But in the, as far as I see, in the current funding mechanism, it won't be funded. Some of the things that we fund at the Sloan Foundation in science, when I send it out for peer review, what I always, I have to now caution the reviewers, because the first thing they tell me is NIH would never fund this. And I say, absolutely. That's why we're interested in it. So I think here is a case where, you know, the Sloan Foundation doesn't have that much money, and we don't spend it all on science and societal issues in science. But I think that we as a community have to sort of make the case and sort of get this rolling. So I think it's essential to the development.
Okay, so, Mark had a comment.
It sounds like a request for a grant application we'll be sending you shortly.
I invite proposals, Mark.
That's coming. You know, short comments to Drew's comments. First, I mean, there are systems that allow for intellectual property exchange. What seems to be required, and I don't think these are secrets, is an analysis of, you know, what are the key patents. There's not tons of them out there. Second, whether those who are holding the key patents are in fact prepared to license them, and if so, on what terms they're prepared to license them. It may well be that the terms that are being offered are very beneficial to the continuing development, at least on the research side of the technology. I don't know that those people have said no, right? Or that they've been asked appropriately whether the answer is yes or no, or on what basis they would contribute. So I think that also has to be tested. And just in the interest of time, I'll answer your other question. Could all this be done in 12 months? I doubt it.
Okay, over here.
Yannis says something.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, as far as tools and applications, just to define for the European Commission grants, those are consortia, and as I said, it comes from the different affiliations, academia, research, or industry. In this case, the industry has to apply with the public rules. They cannot hold the data. They have to publish. And they cannot create patents immediately, but after the finalization of the projects. The projects are usually from 3 minimum to 5 or 6 years. So in this case, as far as the tools versus the applications, for emerging technologies, you start with the idea that, well, if I have to arrive to an application, I need some tools. So you have the excuse or the roadmap or whatever, the roadmap of 5-6 years to develop the tools in order to arrive even at the beginning of some kind of applications. And of course, those are pre-competitive applications, are not applications for ready for the market.
So I want to come back to the roadmap question in a couple of minutes, because I think an important question is there one? All right, again, in semiconductors, the roadmap has played a very important role. And I don't know if a funding agency or a government has a roadmap in synthetic biology. It's arguably, I think we have to talk about outcomes here, and a question is, what are some possible outcomes of this meeting, things that we could undertake that would actually make things better for both innovation and investment in synthetic biology? A roadmap is one possible outcome. I think it is the case in this country that most research is very heavily application-driven. You know, I spent Tuesday with a bunch of folks, Wednesday, a bunch of folks from NIH. And, you know, I confess, sort of astonished to learn that NIH doesn't do healthcare, right? You got a disease, you got an ear at NIH, right? You're a basic biologist or you got a healthcare problem, forget it, right? So, and, you know, if you look at big investments in synthetic biology, it's, hey, we want to tackle malaria. And as Drew pointed out yesterday, that doesn't necessarily translate into generating the next malaria vaccine when a resistant strain shows up after 18 months, all right? So I think the money, even in the research domain, is in the applications. Let's go over here, sorry.
Terry Taylor from the International Council for the Life Sciences. I have two short questions on risk and really related to investment risk in this area. And I was wondering whether, this is addressed to all panel members, whether they could say something of how in a methodological way, that is it possible to bring in the public policy risk that is being driven by public perception, and how that is handled and what a deterrent that is to private investment particularly? And my second question is perhaps addressed to Dr. Economidas about the European Union's sort of background, if you like, policy element on the precautionary principle, and how that is interacting, or the implications of that for investment in the European Union, and perhaps a possible division between European Union and other parts of the world, particularly across the Atlantic, on that aspect. Thank you.
Great. So those are great questions, and let's try and have short answers so we can get to more questions. But I think the important issues here are that there is uncertainty related to public policy and uncertainty related to public perception, and both of those potentially affect the investment environment. Comments?
Well, our program, I'm not so worried about the investment environment. People in investments will make their decision. We're just worried about just the field in general. And that's why, to sort of air these issues, shine bright lights, and come up with some innovative ways of dealing with some of the issues that get identified. No one in this room, all right, it's trained in biochemistry. There's not a biochemist who would say, oh, we've already discovered all the interesting biochemistry. So in terms of dealing with some of the societal issues and managing risk, I don't think we have come up with every idea, so I'm quite optimistic.
Greg, comment?
Yeah, I think that it's a very good question about how does an investment community, how do they perceive the public perception, and how does that create risk? And I think that at least as far as our investment decisions go, it seems that we definitely shy away from the areas of highest debate, the areas where it tends to be controversial, and instead we invest in things like, you know, food, or, you know, making better wine, or things of those nature that aren't necessarily going to have a lot of public, I mean, it's already, you know, the public debate on that, people will want better wine. So, the public perception risk, whereas other things where you talk about, you know, especially in areas where security is worried about, and, you know, opening up the wrong vial chain, you know, and so on, those are areas where people are waiting to see, you know, let the debate rage for a little bit longer before they put a ton into it. But I think part of it is because it's not clear. I mean, a government can legislate overnight something that destroys an investment, and they'll do that because of public perception, in reaction to public perception. So therefore, it's marked as high risk, and it's becomes an even smaller part of any investment portfolio because it's higher risk.
Okay, let's get a few more comments on the table from the audience.
So I have a comment that segues into a couple of questions. So Sheila Jasnoff from Harvard. Yesterday, we began with Dr. Bement talking about the need to get society out in front of the science, or the public out in front of the science. But by this roundtable, we're down to a lawyer, an investor, a foundation person, and a European. Now, with all due respect to Europe, even that does not constitute a highly representative imaging of the public, and yet everybody seems to be aware, as the last set of questions suggested, that something about who the public is, or who publics are, and where they're situated, and what they think, is not irrelevant to investment decisions about synthetic biology, or indeed anything else. So there's this famous, perhaps apocryphal, quote about George Bernard Shaw meeting famed beauty, and the beauty saying to him, enthusing to him, "Oh, Mr. Shaw, just think, if we were married, we could have children who would have my beauty and your brains." And Shaw quipped, "But madam, supposing they were born with your brains and my beauty." In talking about synthetic biology as a sort of semi-outsider, because I've done a lot of work on biotech, but not that much on synbio, I get the impression that there are two large analogies in the background for people who are thinking about investment, and one is information technologies and the other is biotechnologies, and that's not surprising because synbio is seen as a combination of streams coming from both of these areas. Now, with regard to the risks and benefits or the challenges and opportunities, it also strikes me as a somewhat informed observer of these kinds of debates that as long as people are talking about opportunities, they're analogizing more to the info side, and as long as they're analogizing to the risks, they're analogizing more to the bio side. Now, the bio side has been characterized by a mixture of complacency in high places and rejection in low places. So the complacency in high places says there's nothing much new here, and so we don't need to worry. And the ethical issues are the same, and the regulatory issues are the same, and so on. And we've heard a lot of that. Now, who would there be who could... So the question there might be, what does the panel think of this? But the further add-on question, if I'm right about the possible genetic reversal where you end up with Shaw's beauty and the famous beauty's brains, how would you know? What would you need to do in a meeting like this, but also out there when you get out into society, to get a sense of the pitfalls that might be lurking? So, you know, for instance, one could ask, well, what's missing at a discussion like this? And one would immediately notice that several Americans and a few Europeans and one or two people from China do not represent a sort of good mapping of the globe when one is talking about globalization as a major theme here, right? I mean, you know, we're talking about investments where things that get invented in America will have value if they have markets worldwide. So what are those markets about? So that's one question. Another question is, what about representatives of the public? I mean, why isn't the Union of Concerned Scientists sitting there talking about investment decisions, or Greenpeace sitting there talking about investment decisions? So I'll stop there.
Okay. Comments from the panel? Let's, again, Mark, please.
I guess I take your question a little bit to be, who regulates the world in terms of, you know, is there some regulator that's going to convene all the relevant resources and come up with a balanced decision that takes the risks and rewards of development and concludes what development will go forward and what development will not. And we don't have that model right now. It might be a good model, but I don't think we have it. What I've seen, which is somewhat a response to your question, brings it down to a totally different level, which some levels works and some levels doesn't, is, you know, it is rulemaking types of things that we have here, which goes back to the question about regulation. At least in a rulemaking type of process, anybody that's interested has an opportunity to comment and at least have their views heard, with the goal at the end of the day of getting a decision. One of the challenges we've been talking about is whether we want to have that decision now or whether it's really premature to have that decision. And as we listen over the last 2 days, there's a lot of comments. Some would say it's very premature. We don't know enough to start making the decisions. Other would say, gee, we're a long ways down the road, and it's kind of too late. It's somewhere in the middle, I think, and I'm not representing anyone other than our side of the, you know, the legal side and the trade association that I happen to work with. I think there's a view that we ought to go about creating some type of rulemaking process so there is some sort of format and forum that is going to result in a decision on some specific types of issues.
Okay, let's hear from a couple other audience members. We're running out of time, Paula. Hang on a second.
Not on public engagement.
Yeah.
I just want to interject the question about entrepreneurship in terms of investment models. And obviously there's a wealth of evidence from the OECD, from the Kauffman Foundation, from Commission, many other sources about how critical entrepreneurial ecosystems, entrepreneurship, various variations on the theme are to realizing the promise of emerging technologies, particularly when built around some broad, generally applicable sets of technologies. So just wanted to ask the panel how they see the role of the entrepreneurial ecosystem in realizing the promise of synthetic biology. And second, is there anything that you see as in where we are today or down the road in a short time is likely to be different about how entrepreneurial ecosystems work. And here I don't mean just for profit. I'm also talking about the major trends with social entrepreneurs, et cetera, but how entrepreneurship links to the investment models and the future direction of synthetic biology.
So I actually think that my company, the part of the reason why I joined the company that I'm working at now is because of our belief in entrepreneurship and our belief that entrepreneurship actually can thrive if it can be kept away from the boundaries that are put on it, say, for example, most by traditional road mapping or, you know, company strategy or, you know, things of that nature. What I find very fascinating is most what you would call inflection point technologies or something that was truly disruptive to the industry that caused people to throw out all their old products and make new ones, of course, that wasn't on the roadmap of those companies, okay? And in fact, in many cases, you see even today, like the music industry, fighting against digital music distribution and things of that nature. So one of the things I think is key is that entrepreneurship in all areas, if it could be, there's people that are really, really good at being entrepreneurs. They're really good at being innovators and inventing new concepts and doing that. And then there's people that are good at building major product lines and businesses and so on out of it. And if you had some way to continue to encourage people to create new concepts, new models, new products, new ideas, and that's what they were allowed to focus on. Meanwhile, there is a vehicle that takes it once it becomes, you know, gelled enough that it can be involved in wealth creation and continue to feed them and allow them to continue to innovate. And that's part of why we advocate, you know, intellectual property not necessarily being used as a barrier to keeping people from building products, but actually being used as the tool of aggregating and allowing people to build. And so I think that it's something that encourages that community, and I think Symbio is a perfect place for that. There's people that are going to be great at innovating that will probably be pretty bad at building businesses around it, and that we need to find a way to make sure that they can continue to invent, they can continue to innovate, and that the community as a whole can innovate on top of those innovations, but also that there's a path that they're rewarded when somebody else takes it and, you know, has wealth creation.
Okay. Paul, you've been in line for a terribly long time.
Just a small comment. Professor Jasanoff has pioneered the concept and the research on the co-production of science and society for a very long time now. And there is a strange sense of an absence of a vast amount of work and literature in SDS. And I'm not an SDS person. I'm an anthropology of science person and a philosopher, which is strange. On the one hand, you're looking for people doing new things when an awful lot has been done already, and yet somehow it's different. And as to Pam Silver's point about peer review, with 2 minutes to go, this is not the time to get into that. But, I mean, you funded somebody who wrote an article in Nature Biotechnology saying there were no new questions already, and please fund us, and you did. Nothing against that. I didn't, and I also clear item, never asked you for money. I'm fine. Zoe's been terrific. But when we responded that...
Now you'll never get any, but go ahead.
I know. I got famous comment. I got turned down for the ELSI project when I suggested that PCR, about which I wrote a book, might have some social implications. I still talked about that in those days. And the panel led by Charles Kanner wrote back and said, that's absurd. Like the transistor... technologies have no social implications. So this was, I'm not sure the ELSI model is really the way to go. All I'm suggesting here is, I think as other people have and Drew in a different domain has been suggesting, in an emergent, dynamic, complicated field, bringing in the past, and again, what you're doing is great, but there's plenty of room for people who are not yet experts in a field which essentially has no experts. Okay?
So as we close, let me go down the row, and I want to ask Drew Endy to chime in on this as well, and ask each of you if there were one or two things that we could do or change that would improve the innovation and investment environment, right? Improve that ecosystem. What would they be? If someone were to come out of this meeting and say, okay, I'm going to tackle something that's going to make the environment better for innovation and investment, what would you have them tackle?
Well, I guess the first part of that would be a second stimulus package. Beyond that, I think what we need is for sort of a government investment on a strategic basis in the industry to try to create a better knowledge base about what is possible and what is not in the not-too-distant future.
Sorry, government investment in the industry?
That's right, government investment in the SynBio creation that says we're going to fund a certain amount of dollars into innovation through a collaborative of the leading, primarily not-for-profit universities and other research houses to say, you know, assess where are we, what does the patent thicket look like, what's a reasonable place to be in a couple of years, and how should we best try to promote the technology?
So you're looking for an investment in assessing the policy environment. Is that my understanding you or
assessing,
not?
No, assessing the scientific environment,
okay,
and making an investment in those areas where there appears to be the most promise for the broadest platform for future development.
Okay. Greg?
I'm just going to harken back to the closing that I made in my opening remarks, which was we need to create an environment where new innovations can be created in SynBio, that they can be accessed by all researchers, and that innovation can be built on top of innovation, and make sure that that's the case, but done in such a way that we ensure that public good is served in those cases where it's applicable, and done in a way where it also allows for a growing, healthy industry to be built, because without wealth creation, there won't be money coming in. Even governments rely on wealth creation to fund their grants.
Great. So that's put into place a regime in which you can innovate on top of innovation and at the same time create wealth.
Yes, correct.
Great. Paula?
Well, I think that in order to get there, we really need to deal with some of the issues. And again, maybe that's by having a roadmap for synthetic biology that the U.S. Puts together and, again, gets all those things on the table. How do we fund iGEM that, again, is the future workers? How do we make sure that the synthetic biology community has sort of the tools and the resources that are currently not available with the current funding system? I think that's a big gap, and if we address that, I think a lot of things would happen faster, and there'd be more to invest in.
Giannis?
Right. Well, with the European Commission evaluation system is a rather complex peer review system, in which you have a panel of the evaluators of different disciplines. So in this case, several of the topics that I didn't have time to elaborate, like risk of the public concern, the precautionary principle, and stimulating the industries, and for us industries are other small, medium enterprise or bigger industries involved in the research, and then having that as a jumping board going further. With this kind of complex review system, we try to compensate all these sometimes contradictory elements. I mean, contradictory in the sense that if you want to have risk, you are not sure really about the outcome. So the investment is on risk investment. This is one hand. Now, if you want safety or security, you take a more conservative approach to a more, let's say, aggressive approach. So there are, we try with this kind of elaborate system to compensate. I cannot say that always the outcome is right. However, I mean, we try our best.
Okay. Drew, do you have a comment? What would you have us all do?
If individual countries could, by themselves and collectively, develop a strategy by which it becomes possible to make sustained investments in improving the process of engineering biology, developing biology as a technology, realizing the promise, which we hear about this being the century of biology as a science and engineering as a discipline coming together, and actually doing that, having that be an integrated strategy that makes it okay for people to explore improvements, say, in DNA synthesis, without being derailed by political concerns around biosecurity, right? So not only do we have to have sustained investments in tools that support the process of engineering biology, but these need to be coupled to political and social considerations relating to equity, ownership, safety, security, anything else you want to talk about, humanity. So let's get that going, and let's have it give everybody an umbrella in which we can continue to pull this together responsibly.
Great. Thanks. Thank you very much. Before we thank the panel and you get lunch, I've been asked to request that all of the session chairs remain here for just 5 minutes to set up a panel that will take place at the end of the day today. Thank you, panelists, very much.